Hello, and welcome to the History of the Early Church. Episode 59, The Peace of the Church. In this episode, we at long last conclude our narrative of the Great Persecution by following the events which finally and permanently made Christianity legal throughout the entire Roman Empire. In the West, we left off with Constantine in Rome, following his victory over Maxentius. After the Senate voted him the title Maximus Augustus, Constantine used his new authority to issue a letter to Maximinus Daya in late 312, demanding the Great Persecution end immediately. Over in the East, we left off with Maximinus receiving Constantine's letter. Of the four emperors who had perpetrated the Great Persecution, three had fallen. First Maximian in the summer of 310, then Galerius in May of 311, and finally Diocletian himself in December of 311. There remain now only Maximinus, arguably the worst of them all. Following Constantine's letter, however, the Eastern Emperor only ceased to actively persecute his Christian subjects. Official toleration and restitution were still withheld for the churches of Anatolia, the Levant, Egypt, and Libya. Only the defeat of Maximinus himself would truly bring about a final end to the Great Persecution. Constantine's stay in Rome was brief but eventful. In addition to forging his alliance with the Roman Senate, the Western Emperor also set about damning the memory of his defeated rival. Maxentius was branded a tyrant, a word which, in a Christian context, soon began to take on the additional connotation of persecutor, a ruler who unjustly oppressed the people of God. Maxentius, of course, did not persecute his Christian subjects. Though he started off well by issuing toleration, his relationship with the early church was strained by his decision to exile the bishops of Rome, his delay to grant property restitution, and his general behavior late in his reign. However, he was certainly no Diocletian or Galerius. Constantine began erasing Maxentius's mark on the city, both taking over his building projects and building over existing structures. Monumental building was considered a hallmark of a great Roman emperor going back to Augustus, and building temples to his patron deity in particular was also something a good emperor did to maintain divine support. Shortly after entering the city, Constantine permanently disbanded the old Praetorian Guard and demolished the barracks for their cavalry arm. On top of the structure, the emperor planned to build the first imperial Christian church. As we've discussed before, Christians did have dedicated church buildings prior to the Great Persecution, such as the large one demolished in Nicomedia. However, with the emperor now involved, the building of churches took on a much grander form. On November 11th, 312, on the ruins of the Praetorian Cavalry Barracks, construction began on the Lateran Basilica. When it was finally completed 12 years later, the Lateran Basilica became the official seat of the Bishop of Rome, and has remained so up to the present day. The modern successor to Constantine's church is the Cathedral of St. John of the Lateran. Constantine was doubtless introduced to Miltiades, the current Bishop of Rome, by his chief ecclesiastical advisor, Osius of Cordova. In addition to building this church, Constantine also granted the Pope the Lateran Palace next to the new basilica. The palace appears to have originally belonged to the emperor's wife Fausta, but now it became the living quarters of the bishop. Constantine would go on to build many other churches in Rome, including the Basilica of the Apostles on the Appian Way, the joint cult site for Peter and Paul, as well as other smaller churches. Many of these were dedicated to local martyrs, such as the deacon Lawrence, who died under Valerian, or Marcellinus and Peter, who were martyred only 10 years earlier. These churches were a visible symbol of the victory of the martyrs over the pagan persecutors. The choice of the basilica for public Christian architecture is an interesting one. Basilicas were not used as pagan temples, but instead as public spaces near forums for various purposes, such as administrative or commercial activity. Perhaps the emperor figured it simply wouldn't do to construct houses of worship in the same style as the temples of the old gods. The Christian basilica, with the now familiar cross-shaped structure, quickly became the standard for churches in late antiquity, and still remains so in various parts of the world today. One major church I haven't yet mentioned, which is usually credited to Constantine, is the old St. Peter's Basilica on the Vatican Hill. The Vatican Hill had been the location of the Circus of Nero, and as such was where the first persecuting emperor had publicly tortured and killed numerous Christians nearly 250 years earlier. Since at least the mid-2nd century, the tomb of the Apostle Peter had been venerated by Christians on the Vatican Hill as the site of his martyrdom. Traditionally, Constantine is believed to have begun the construction of Old St. Peter's. However, this has been well challenged by more recent scholarship, which argues instead that it was during the reign of the emperor's sons that the church was built. If you want to dive into this issue more deeply, see the secondary sources listed on the blog post for this episode. If this view is correct, then it is an example of Constantine being given credit for something one of his successors actually did, something we will likely come across again in the future. One group who could not have failed to have noticed the massive increase in Christianity's public profile was the old senatorial aristocracy. Committedly pagan and generally hostile towards Christians, the Roman Senate will remain decidedly tied to the traditional cults until the end of the century. Now, as we saw two episodes ago, the Senate had become an important power base of Constantine's, and the emperor did not want to threaten his alliance with the empire's elite. Not only that, but Constantine ruled over an empire which was overwhelmingly pagan. Christians constituted around 10% of the population, and most of those Christians were in the east, suffering under Maximinus Daya. Rome and North Africa were among the most heavily Western Christian areas, but Christians were still definitively in the minority. Were Constantine not such a skilled politician, this may have caused a problem. Though the emperor had placed his trust in the Christian God to grant him victory, he was not insensitive to the realities of religious demographics. If he was going to rule the Roman Empire, he was going to have to make sure he didn't isolate his majority pagan subjects, especially the elites and the soldiers he needed to maintain power. To this end, Constantine pursued a policy for the next decade or so of using religious language and imagery which both pagans and Christians could interpret positively. Historian Harold Drake argues that the emperor was trying to build a general consensus of inclusive monotheism, which all his subjects could support. Coins, monuments, and other official communications utilized vague language to refer to the supreme god or the highest divinity. Christians would, of course, read these as references to their heavenly father, while pagans would understand this as the supreme being who loomed above all the other local pantheons of the world, the one spoken of by the philosophers. Solar and light imagery also continued to be used. Connecting the supreme god with symbols of the unconquered sun would be familiar to pagan quasi-monotheism, while Christian use of solar and light imagery already had precedence. You may remember from one of our first 3 centuries episodes that Christians in the Roman catacombs reappropriated sun chariot imagery for depicting Christ. If Constantine was already receiving biblical instruction from Osius and Lactantius, then he may have been alerted to passages in scripture where solar or light language was applied to God, such as descriptions of the glory of the Lord shining forth, or Jesus Christ as the light of the world. Constantine himself, still being a neophyte, may have initially seen little functional difference between Saul and Christ in certain respects. Christians worshipped on the day of the resurrection, which was also the day of the sun. If the calculation hypothesis is true, many Christians were already celebrating the birth of Jesus on December 25th, the same day as the Nativity of Sol Invictus. As such, solar and light iconography could serve as a useful bridge for pagans in transitioning towards Christian monotheism. Nevertheless, many elite pagans still appear to have shown unease about the emperor's conversion. This may be why most of the city's new church buildings were located away from the major centers of senatorial urban space, including the Lateran Basilica, though this could just have easily been an issue of available real estate. A few years after his victory over Maxentius, the Senate formally dedicated to Constantine a massive triumphal arch to commemorate his victory and his Decennalia, the emperor's 10-year anniversary. The inscription on the arch makes reference to the emperor being directed to liberate the city of Rome by inspiration of the divinity. Normal practice would simply name the god in question, whether Jupiter, Mars, or Sol Invictus. The calculated vagueness stands out in a monument constructed under traditionally pagan senators. When Constantine was back in Trier in 313, another Gallic orator delivered a panegyric to the emperor. The orator, a pagan himself, studiously avoids explicitly Christian terminology, but also noticeably declines to name a specific god, like Sol or Hercules. Instead, the vague language of the supreme, highest divinity is used. As we noted earlier, Constantine himself adopted a similar approach for the time being. Aside from his Labarum standard, explicitly Christian imperial iconography is scarce for this period, although there is a silver medallion dated to 315, which does clearly show the emperor wearing the Cairo symbol on his helmet, a feature which Eusebius actually mentions in his Life of Constantine. For now, though, while Constantine was ruler of only the western half of the empire, such a policy of inclusive monotheism would more or less be the order of the day. In addition to new church buildings, Constantine also began granting privileges and benefits to the Christian clergy. For starters, clerics would be given the same exemptions from compulsory public service that the religious officers of other cults were given, including pagans and Jews. These included many of the municipal duties, taxes, and expenses levied on cities through the decurions of their local councils. Constantine did not, however, exempt churches or clergy from the primary tax of the imperial administration, land. Non-exemption from the land tax meant that although Christian ministers were now privileged and distinguished, they were not on the level of the wealthy upper classes, especially the Senate. Again, Constantine did not want his patronage of his new faith to potentially threaten his alliance with the old guard. Buildings, grants, and privileges were the beginnings of Constantine's patronage of the Christian church, and we will see much more as the narrative continues. It appears that around this time, many of the members of Constantine's household followed the emperor in embracing the Christian faith, including his sister Constantia and his mother, Flavia Julia Helena, although some historians posit her conversion actually preceded her son's. Both of these empresses will play important roles in our story. Helena, especially, would remain active in Rome during the 310s and early 320s, where she patronized Christian churches and had a chapel constructed in her palace, which later became a church in its own right. Interestingly, another imperial lady who converted to Christianity, perhaps also around this time, was the emperor's mother-in-law, Eutropia, the widow of Maximian and mother of Fausta and Maxentius. Eutropia will also make another appearance in our narrative down the road. Not long after celebrating the Feast of Epiphany in January of 313, Constantine departed Rome for Milan, where he and Licinius met to cement their alliance and discuss plans for the future. Licinius and Constantia were wed, and matters of public policy were determined. The empire's 12 dioceses were divided evenly between the two Augusti, with the border of Italy and Pannonia marking the dividing line. Licinius, of course, would need to defeat Maximinus in order to claim the provinces of the Near East. Most importantly for our narrative was the question of Christianity. Christians in the West already enjoyed full legal toleration and property restitution, though the latter was still not complete in the territories Constantine had just conquered from Maxentius. Christians in the Balkans had enjoyed toleration since Galerius's edict back in 311. Licinius would now extend property restitution to these areas as well. Toleration and restitution would also be promulgated in the East once Maximinus had fallen. But what form exactly would this new imperial policy take? The decisions to be agreed upon by Constantine and Licinius at Milan needed to do more than just allow Christians to exist. They needed to incorporate Christianity into the framework of the empire, alongside traditional religion. First, the emperors agreed to a policy which allowed all citizens, Christians or otherwise, to adhere to whatever religious devotion they saw fit. A remarkable endorsement of individual thinking on the part of autocrats. Scholars have detected here the influence of Lactantius on Constantine, who in his Divine Institutes had argued religious freedom was a natural right, in contrast to the coercive policies of Diocletian and Galerius. The policy also fit into the overall framework of inclusive monotheism Constantine, and now Licinius, were upholding. The supreme deity was to be both their protectors. Licinius himself never became a Christian, and unfortunately would turn against his Christian subjects in the final years of his reign. However, at this point in time, he was still perfectly willing to go along with Constantine's pro-Christian stance. He would even invoke the highest god during his war against Maximinus, though he obviously didn't interpret the identity of that god in quite the same way Constantine did. With events in the West covered, let us now turn our attention to the East. Things had not been going well for Maximinus Dia since the end of 312. Chafing in Antioch from his failed Armenian campaign, the muzzled persecutor now had a drought to contend with. By the spring of 313, the lack of rainfall had produced a severe famine in the East. Thousands were starving to death as grain prices skyrocketed. Alongside famine came a disease, which caused ulcers and blindness. The work the Eastern Augustus had done to reignite popular pagan hatred of Christianity was undermined as local Christians distributed bread, cared for the sick, and buried the dead for their Christian and non-Christian neighbors alike. The splendor Maximinus had boasted of the previous year as clear evidence of divine favor had evaporated. Persecution had not resulted in the Pax Deorum. However, the Eastern Emperor could not remain focused on this for too long, as wider political circumstances once again dictated he take decisive action. While the nuptials of Licinius and Constantia were being celebrated in Milan, Maximinus seized the opportunity to invade Europe. In early 313, he departed Antioch and force-marched his army and supply train across Asia Minor. The harsh season, combined with the famine and plague, took a heavy toll on his 70,000-man force. When Maximinus finally reached Byzantium, he attempted to bribe the small garrison to defect to his side and let him cross. However, the soldiers of the city remained loyal to Licinius and held out for 11 days before surrendering. Having at last crossed into Europe, Maximinus then moved on the Thracian capital of Heraclea Perinthus, but again was delayed for several days by the pro-Licinius garrison. Such delays prevented Maximinus from getting a foothold in Thrace until late April, and allowed Licinius enough time to hastily muster a force of 30,000 men and advance to Adrianople. Maximinus was unable to move further west. Battle would soon be joined near Zeralum, modern-day Korlu in Turkey. In preparation, Maximinus made a vow to Jupiter that if he was victorious, he would utterly wipe out the Christian name. According to Lactantius, Licinius received a dream where an angel appeared to him, dictating a prayer to the supreme god. The angel is said to have promised Licinius that he and his army would be victorious if they recited this prayer before the battle, though some modern historians argue the prayer was actually given to Licinius by Constantine. Licinius intended to give battle on the first day of May, looking to defeat Maximinus on his anniversary, just as Constantine had Maxentius. Maximinus, however, decided to give battle the day before, and therefore use the 8th anniversary of his rule to celebrate a victory. The two forces drew up against each other, though Licinius and his men stopped mid-March to thrice offer the prayer to the supreme god. After the perfunctory diplomacy ended, the Battle of Zeralum began. Despite his force outnumbering Licinius, the tide of battle eventually turned against Maximinus. Seeing defeat was now upon him, Maximinus fled the battlefield. The enemy commander having now deserted, Licinius quickly gained victory. Maximinus removed his imperial regalia and adopted the dress of a slave. Stopping only briefly in Nicomedia to pick up his wife, children, and a few trusted officials, Maximinus made his way to Cappadocia, where he redonned the purple and gathered what remaining forces he could muster. It was at this point that Maximinus at last conceded to his Christian subjects and formally issued his own edict of toleration and restitution. In his law, the emperor still refused to admit any fault, lauding Diocletian and Maximian, while also blaming the mass death and suffering of Christians on subordinates misinterpreting and abusing his orders. Now he declared he would remove all suspicion and doubt with a formal decree. Like his uncle Galerius before him, Maximinus was compelled to admit defeat. Licinius, meanwhile, was consolidating his gains in Nicomedia. On June 13th, the governor of Bithynia posted the letter of the new Eastern Emperor, stipulating the religious policy Licinius had agreed to with Constantine at Milan. As Licinius conquered more and more of Maximinus's territory, the law was subsequently handed down to local governors to be officially posted in their provinces. This letter of Licinius, a law issued in the name of Constantine and himself, is the document commonly referred to today as the so-called Edict of Milan, even though it was not an edict, nor was it issued from Milan. As Licinius marched east, Maximinus retreated to the Cilician Gates in an attempt to hold the pass. However, Licinius's forces broke through, and Maximinus fled to the city of Tarsus. There, besieged from both land and sea, Maximinus decided to end it all. After gorging himself on a feast, he swallowed poison. However, the toxin did not have the desired effect. The Tetrarch vomited out his feast, and the poison instead took a slow, painful course. Consumed in agony and pain, Lactantius and Eusebius even state he implored Christ to have mercy on him. Finally, in the summer of 313, Maximinus Dia, the fourth and final of the persecutors, died. After a full, bloody decade, the great persecution was at long last over. Licinius proceeded on to Antioch soon after. The memory of Maximinus was damned, and his portraits and statues were thrown down across the empire. A ruthless purge of the old tetrarchic dynasty followed Licinius' conquest of the East. Severianus, the son of the Western Emperor Severus, who had loyally served in Maximinus' army to the end, was put to death. Maximinus' widow, who had thrown Christian women into the Orontes, was herself drowned in the same river. Her and Maximinus' young son Maximus, as well as their daughter, were also executed. The daughter of Maximinus had been betrothed to Galerius' illegitimate son Candidianus. Candidianus himself had already been arrested and killed when Licinius captured Nicomedia. With Candidianus at the time was his adoptive mother, the Augusta Valeria. With Candidianus' death, Valeria fled from Licinius again, along with her mother Prisca. Licinius ordered both imperial ladies hunted down. The two women managed to hide for 15 months before being arrested, tried, and publicly beheaded in Thessalonica. Afterwards, their bodies were thrown into the sea. A tragic end to two tragic lives. In addition to eliminating the surviving Jovians and Herculeans, Licinius's regime began to prosecute the various high-ranking anti-Christian officials who had loyally served Maximinus in enforcing the Great Persecution. First among them was Pucetius, a member of Maximinus's inner circle and his chief finance minister. Also executed was Clodius Colchianus, the persecuting prefect of Egypt, who had deployed such horrible tortures in Alexandria and had also executed Phileas and Philo Romus. Valerius Firmilianus, the seasoned veteran and longtime comrade of Maximinus, whose tenure as governor of Palestine had witnessed the worst bouts of persecution in the Holy Land, was compelled to commit suicide. In Antioch itself, the priests of the new cult of Zeus Philios were all arrested. Under torture, they confessed the entire oracle was a fraud concocted by Theotechnus, the former curator of Antioch, who you'll remember had produced the oracle which helped relaunch the persecution in 311, the same man who had then been promoted to the governorship of Galatia and persecuted Christians there without mercy. Theotechnus was arrested, tortured, and finally executed by Licinius, with the other priests meeting their ends right after. Nor were these the only ministers of oracles put to death. The priests of Apollo at Didyma, the very same oracle which had convinced Diocletian to launch the persecution a decade earlier, were also executed. Other instigators of the persecution appear to have died before this time. The great philosopher Porphyry of Tyre was fortunate enough to have expired not long after the persecution began. No mention is made in our sources on the fate of Socinus Hierocles, the composer of the anti-Christian tract Lover of Truth and career official under the Tetrarchs. His last appearance was back in 310-311 during his prefecture of Egypt, when he was assailed by the martyr Odysseus of Lycia. If Hierocles was still alive in the summer of 313, it's highly likely he too perished. The prosecution of such decorated magistrates seems to have spurred other officials to present their own court transcripts of the trials of Christian martyrs in order to plead for clemency. Such was the fate of the regime which had orchestrated the greatest persecution in the history of the early church. As for the church itself, peace had finally come. The year 313 is traditionally used to mark the point in time when the heroic age of martyrdom came to an end, the so-called peace of the church. Although this isn't completely accurate, 313 is nevertheless a critical turning point in our story. However, the Christians of the East at the time could not bask in the glow of this historical moment. No, there was work to be done. The Christian world had not sat idly by waiting for the Great Persecution to be over. There were issues to be discussed, churches to be rebuilt, and new bishops to be consecrated. In late 312, the Church of Alexandria had finally been able to elect a successor to the martyred Peter, a certain Achilles. However, Achilles only briefly sat upon the throne of St. Mark before the Egyptian papacy passed to Alexander. The Christians of Alexandria and Egypt were especially affected by the persecution. To this day, the Coptic calendar dates its years from 284, the era of Diocletian, or the era of the martyrs. Alexandria and the Thebaid had witnessed the worst the persecution had to offer. An early tradition states that 660 Christians were martyred in Alexandria alone in the period from the start of the persecution to the Edict of Galerius. Egypt was also the scene of the Miletian Schism, which, despite Peter's martyrdom, still remained, and Alexander would be forced to confront the issue head-on. In Asia Minor, in cities like Neo-Caesarea and Ankara, councils were held to address disciplinary and communal issues, composing canons on subjects ranging from the lapsed to marriage to the catechumenate. The regular life of the church was being restored. However, the most momentous Anatolian synod of this time occurred in Cappadocian Caesarea in the summer or autumn of 314. The council ordained and commissioned a Parthian Christian of royal descent named Gregory. His mission? Baptize the newly converted king of Armenia, Tiridates III. Tiridates, you may remember, had been restored to his throne by Diocletian and Galerius a few years before the persecution began. He had also persecuted Christians like his imperial benefactors, including Gregory. Now, though, the king was receiving baptism from a man he had once imprisoned. Following his conversion, Tiridates declared Christianity the official religion of Armenia, making his kingdom the first Christian nation in the history of the world. We shall discuss the Armenian Church in greater detail in a future episode. For our two major historical sources, life also began to return to normal. Lactantius eventually made his way back to Nicomedia and resumed his teaching chair. There, around 314 or 315, he published his pamphlet On the Deaths of the Persecutors, and dedicated it to the local confessor Donatus. Over in Palestine, Eusebius, now in his 50s, was honored with the bishopric of Caesarea Maritima, making him the new metropolitan of Palestine. A few years later, he visited Tyre again to deliver a sermon on the new church building being dedicated there by the bishop Paulinus. In his church history, Eusebius sees earlier persecutions as the work of the devil, trying to get Christians to lose their salvation. But for the great persecution, Eusebius takes a different view. The squabbling and infighting among Christians during the little piece of the church, which Eusebius chose not to comment on directly, had incurred the wrath of God against his people. However, like the Assyrians and Babylonians before them, the Tetrarchs went too far, and God raised up agents of deliverance in the form of Constantine and Licinius. In the Sermon on the Church of Tyre, Eusebius paints the end of the persecution as a new return from exile. He likens the new church in Tyre to the Second Jerusalem Temple, and depicts Bishop Paulinus as a new Zerubbabel, the first leader of the Jewish exiles returning from Babylon, who began the rebuilding of the temple. The Christian church, long in the throes of Diocletianic captivity, had at last been delivered by God, just as he had done for his people centuries earlier. The hope and optimism of Eusebius's writing here is palpable. But like Ezra and Nehemiah before him, the new bishop of Caesarea would soon discover things were not going to be so simple. But that is for another day. We'll leave the Eastern Christians here for right now. recovering, and even somewhat flourishing in this new age of peace. Next episode, we're going to follow Eusebius' example and take some time to reflect on the Great Persecution. As exciting as the narrative has been, I think we need a bit of a breather before moving on to the next set of events. We've covered some complex as well as dark and violent subject matter. I want to spend some time analyzing aspects of the narrative, as I believe there are certain conclusions we can draw that will help us not only understand the Great Persecution better, but also provide us with important implications for the future. Thank you for listening. If you have questions or feedback about the podcast, you can email me at historyoftheearlychurch@gmail.com. Please don't forget to rate and review the show on whatever podcast platform you use. Be sure to visit the Facebook page, facebook.com/earlychurchpodcast. And don't forget to visit the website at historyoftheearlychurch.wordpress.com.